Folks, just a few minutes earlier than scheduled, which is good, as late in the day as we're starting today. We're about 3 hours after our normal start time, which means I'm usually finishing up right about now, but this is worth doing. We have a special guest named Abraham Pittman, and he is an engineer. He is also a homesteader, and he's going to be talking to us today about those two things put together, homesteading with an engineering mindset. I think this is something that really fits well. And what I found is, like, some of the best people I know in the permaculture space are not actually known that heavily as permaculture people. You know, like when I think of Alan Booker as a perfect example, he actually has a PDC that he does for people that is only for engineers. Now, anybody can take it, but he's like, if you don't have an engineering background, it's probably not going to work out for you. And then the other thing I've always noticed is, like, some of the best engineers I know, now they may not be credentialed engineers, maybe they didn't go to college or engineering school or something like that, but they are engineers in what they do by trade, are farmers. I have seen farmers come up with some of the most ingenious systems thinking oriented projects of any group of people anywhere. And it makes perfect sense, especially when you're talking, like, you know, you're kind of old school farmer, you're a guy that has a few hundred acres, maybe even up to like 1,200 or something. You're not talking about like the guy with like 40,000 acres. And of course there's engineering because like it's an autonomous tractor driving around or something. I'm talking about the guy that actually makes a living from his land and works with locals and things like that. Those guys are always incredible engineers. I met one up in Missouri a few years ago, and some of the work he was doing was outstanding. In fact, the soil improvement that his system created was such that when he sent soil samples in, the people at the testing facility, knowing where it came from, called him and said, "You're going to get in trouble." And he said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, you're plowing native prairie soil. And that's, you know, that's illegal. You can't, like, untouched prairie soil is protected in your area. And he's like, "No, that's the depleted soil that was here when I got here 4 years ago. That was the improvement that his systems made." So when I got Abraham's request to be on the show, I'm like, yeah, man, we'll talk, you know, homesteading with somebody with an engineering mindset. I think that'll be great. And I checked out his website and stuff. So we'll have him on in just a moment. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is KnifeKits.com. KnifeKits is, I think at this point, the sponsor that we have had continuously for the longest period of time. They might be the longest continuous sponsor of any podcast anywhere in the world, because they have been a sponsor of my show since 2010. It's 2026. That's 16 freaking years, guys. So check them out. They are a company that does what they do, says what they do, and do what they say, right? Knife kits. That's what you actually get there. You can get all the stuff you need to build a knife from a kit, or you can get raw materials and do things like, you know, if you're a master bladesmith, you can get really cool Damascus steel, other high-end steel there, pins, handle material, things like mammoth tusk and buffalo horn and all kinds of really great stuff. Check them out today at KnifeKits.com. And MSB members, they do a discount for you guys. It's not huge, but they're working on really small margins, so they do what they can to support the show. Next up today, we have Start 9 Sovereign Computing. Do you know that most of you guys are storing your data and your information and using account management tools and things like that in what they call cloud services, and that there really is no cloud? There's no such thing as a cloud. It's not up here like Kamala says, right? Like, the cloud is just somebody else's computer. It's Amazon's computer or it's Google's computer. What if you could access all your files from anywhere in the world completely encrypted with no reliance on a third-party service whatsoever? What if you could control all your own data? What if you could also, like, run your own Bitcoin node? You could run your own Lightning node. You could run BT Pay Server and act as your own payment processor on your website. What if you could have end-to-end encrypted messaging as good as anything the military has? And not only is it encrypted and impossible to break, like, you really can't even see it unless you're part of the group. And the only way people get in the group is you let them know that they can get in and how to get in. What if you could do all that with one little box at your house? you can with Start 9 private servers. Check them out today. And they do a discount for MSB members, and you can stack that discount with the discount gift card and sats back that you'll get with the fold card if you're into that as well. With that, let's go ahead and bring our special guest on. Abraham, man, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me there.
Like I said, we're going to have you on today to talk to everyone about kind of the world of like homesteading and doing that with an engineering mindset. I thought it was a great topic. What I always like to start out with, though, and I know you listen to the show, so you probably know this, it is not necessarily the topic of the day, but how did you get into the world that you're in? One, engineering, two, kind of this homesteading space. Like, because I'm guessing when you were like a 9-year-old, you probably wanted to be a cowboy or some shit, not grow up and to be an engineer that's in a homesteading. So what led you here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I often hear you say that, but I'm kind of the opposite. I always kind of did want to be what I am, sort of thing. As a kid, I sort of liked, I grew up sort of country, or you know, in farming and homesteading, that sort of thing. And I always liked sort of building things and making things. And I sort of, you know, went away to university and lived in the city for a while, but I always sort of kept that small, you know, suburban homesteading, and then progressively moved away and went back out to the country, and now live in the tropics doing the engineering and my homesteading, really.
Cool, man. So are you an engineer by trade? Like, what I mean, like, do you have a job off the homestead that's engineering related?
Yes. So I'm actually what's known as a field service engineer, and okay. I work for a rotating equipment company. Basically, make turbo compressors and turbines. And so I actually go out in the field, and I will typically fix them, overhaul them, troubleshoot, that sort of stuff. So a bit more hands-on than perhaps an office-based engineer sort of thing. It's somewhat of a global role, so it typically tends to be I work from home, and then I will go where is required. Usually it's in the Asia Pacific region, but it is all over the world.
Can we start off then with how can thinking like an engineer help everyday people build more reliable and resilient systems for homesteading and preparedness as well? Because it is, you know, the survival podcast here.
Well, I think it's more about thinking about the system or whatever it is that you're doing holistically. So it's more a case of not just grabbing something and hoping it'll work, or seeing something and thinking it'll work right away. It's more about planning for potential failure modes, any sort of redundancy that may come in, any form of additional reliability you need to factor in, that sort of stuff. I feel like there's often times where people will just implement a solution or get something without thinking about what's going to happen later on down the line and how they're going to be able to fix it or work with it.
Yeah, I would tie that into to like this. Like, I call it YouTube reproduction, right? Like, where somebody will see somebody do something on YouTube, like a Hoogle mount, right? Like, this should be a perfect example because that was like light, white hot 10 years ago. And then, like, well, I want one. So then they go find a bunch of wood and they make a big pile out of it and they put a big bunch of dirt on it. And when they do that, they usually put it wherever it will work for them to have a big pile of dirt they can plant stuff in. There's no real connection to anything else. So what they see is the technique only, and then there's no strategy or tactics involved to the implementation of the techniques. And I've got this isolated dirt pile, you know, maybe by the back fence that's a couple hundred yards from the house, disconnected from everything because I wanted one, and that's where I could make one now, because that's how everybody is, right? I want it now, microwave thinking. I want it now, where if you thought through it, you probably wouldn't put it where you just did, or you might not do it at all because you would think about all the different reasons you were doing it and how it would tie in with your total overriding goal. And that seems to me like I used to work in the telecom space and I was in sales, and the people I was selling to were by and large engineers. And they were always thinking at kind of this, like, I don't care that you have this really great switch. I need to know how it's going to integrate with the system that I'm building for my customer. And I think that if people can apply that on their homesteads, maybe we can get less disconnected elements that end up, then people end up hating them. And then you hear them, they make the video like 3 years later and say, this sucks and it doesn't work. Well, it was never implemented because it was never integrated.
Also, like in the example for the switch, not just necessarily what system's going to work now, does it allow for expansion down the line, and will this be future-proof? In the case of a Hoogle mount, does it actually, you know, you've seen one season. Is it, does it flood there during another time of the year? Are you going to need access with your vehicle? So I think it's a case of forward planning and trying to really see what is the holistic, like the full life cycle of this sort of thing.
Yeah, I think when you think of the permaculture terms of like water access structure, you just saw one there, like don't design access out of your system.
Yes.
Because I've seen people do that, like with swales is another design element where like they'll go all the way to the end of a property line or all the way to a fence line or something like that. Okay, now you've got a giant ditch that you can't get equipment through or get a tractor through or something like that. Like you've now designed out one of the strategic things we want to keep.
Yeah, completely agree. Also, I find with things like machinery or something that someone builds and they'll have something. And now when you ever need a change of bearing, you can't get into it because you haven't thought about what is my maintenance going to be down the line, that sort of thing.
There is a meme, very famous meme, and it's the, I think it's the Cadillac North Star engine that did this. And it says why mechanics hate engineers.
Yes, exactly.
And have you seen it? You know what I'm talking about? Where they have top off the engine and the starter motor is on the top of the engine block, and you have to take half the damn thing apart to swap a starter motor, which is, to be fair, I haven't changed a starter motor in a long time, but traditionally starter motors are one of those things that like you usually end up replacing a couple times during the life of a vehicle. I guess they've gotten better, but man, I've never had to do that job, but I would be looking for the guy with a pipe wrench, you know, to beat him with if that was my car, the car I had to work on.
Yes, I am an engineer, but I am also what we'd call over here a tradesperson fitter. I think you call them millwrights. And depending on who I'm talking to, I'll say I'm a millwright instead because, nobody likes the engineers when they do stuff like that.
Well, it's because so the work you're doing involves actually working on the equipment, not just designing the equipment. So you have to be on the other side of it. And that changes instantly everything. Whoever the engineer is behind the Humvee and the tunnel cover, in a Humvee, you're sitting, you got a driver and a passenger, and you got this tunnel cover. You can access the back of the engine and other parts of the compartment from this aluminum tunnel cover that you pull off. And when you do any work on the valve covers, you have to disconnect the fuel injector lines to get them out. And if they would have made that opening a half inch bigger, you wouldn't shred your hand every time you turn a wrench. But, you know, since they don't have to work on it, I guess they don't think that way. But I think there's like, don't we have to filter things too? Like there's times where you just look at something and go, that just needs that. Just do it like quick, expedient, down and dirty solution. And then there's times that we need to think a little bit about it. And then there's times that we need to be like, this is actually a really key long-term element. It's not just to keep something alive for a week or so or something like that. Like, this needs some real thought before we act. How do you kind of make that choice?
I think it's basically a system of triaging sort of thing. And I think I've heard you say before, you don't need a drill bit, you need a hole.
Correct.
And sometimes you do have to sort of say, okay, what am I doing right here? I'm making a chicken yard. And if the chicken yard, if the door is off by, you know, half an inch or whatever, it's not really going to matter sort of thing. And we don't need to spend all our time chasing precision in that sort of instance, right? We're just going to be wasting our time. And it's oftentimes, I think the saying is, don't let perfect become the enemy of good. Just sometimes it's just get it done. But other times you can't neglect that. And it has to be you have to think in terms of what is the consequence of failure and how much do I actually need this? And then sort of on that, then you sort of say, all right, this is how much precision I need. This is what level I need to go to sort of thing. So I like to think of things like that. Say, for instance, my electrical system, that has to work, right? They can't have faulty electrics, right? You have to make sure that's properly. My pumps for my water, if I don't have that, I don't have water. But if the gate squeaks a little bit, not a big deal sort of thing. Yeah. So I like to try and really prioritize what I'm working on and how much effort I put to get the best result.
Yeah, I think we kind of have to look at like kind of like the same way we look at like scale of permanence, right? Like, what is this thing? If I decide I don't like it, how hard is it to change or move? How much am I going to rely on it? If it does work, how long do I expect it to be here and to work? If it's something that I expect to like get me through till winter, and then that I'm going to use that winter to build something for next season, that's way different than something I'm going to say, well, I want this to be here for 10 years or more. I have to put different levels of thought based on that. It makes me think of like one of the things Joel Salatin will talk about in his talks is, say you think I need a fence there. Like, it's really simple to put in a very inexpensive temporary fence. And so that's what you should do. And if 2 years later that thing is still there and you don't hate it, now maybe you make it a permanent fence. So that's like one example there, because he said, I've seen plenty of people put fence lines and spend tens of thousands of dollars on fencing and then need to move it. And they could have thrown in some rebar and some charged wires and used that as a containment fence for livestock, for instance, and then they would have figured out they hate it and they would just move it very easily and have very little money into it. Whereas when you put something in where you're spending a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of labor, and then changing that is going to be difficult, give it more of that, what's the word we use for it, due diligence prior to making your final choice.
If you actually think about it, that sort of thing could be considered prototyping, really. We often think of prototyping as machines, but we are sort of putting out first generation sort of alpha tests, beta tests and whatnot, and then going towards that more permanent solution. But there is a bit of a saying I come across in heavy industry, and it says that there's nothing more permanent than a temporary solution that still works.
Yeah, there is that, isn't there? Like you say, like, I'm just going to throw that there and use it till I get by.
Yeah.
And then it works. And then you just start like, well, I'll get to it because now it's not highly important. But what usually you tell me if you see this different. I have found a lot of times then that temporary solution will eventually fail. Yes, and it will tend to fail at the worst possible time that it could possibly fail for you. Right.
Yes. And I often find that you put something off for 6 months and then you finally do it and it took you an hour. And it's like, why did I wait this long to do this?
Too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing how long it can happen to all of us, right? I thought I had something to go on the back of the idea. That's right. It's not just about building things, though, as well. It's also about things that you buy as well. Like, for instance, I don't buy expensive TVs. I buy cheap TVs because I can buy a TV that's pretty good for one-fifth of the price of a major brand sort of thing, and then I can then just use that until it fails, and then it costs one-fifth, but it lasts three-quarters as long as a more expensive one would. And because it's a non-critical item, I can just go out and buy another one. But I drive a Toyota vehicle because I don't want it failing on me. I use all Milwaukee gear because I want a good power tool. You know, it's sort of like that thing of prioritizing what is the actual consequence of this thing failing and how much do I use it and how much does it cost, that sort of thing.
Got you. Well, that makes sense. How do you decide what parts of a system are important enough to have backups and which parts are fine without, full redundancy? I mean, I think obviously, like, you kind of mentioned some things already, like pumps and things like that. Like, I have pumps that run aquatic systems that if they fail and nothing is done about it, then, like, everything dies. So that obviously is something that I've built redundancy into. But is it always that cut and dry?
I think for the most part it is. I mean, obviously there's always nuance to things, but it's a case of, like, yeah, as we said before, what is the actual consequences of failure sort of thing? And how difficult is it to repair something? So I've heard you talk about those pumps before, and you say that you just have them on the shelf sort of thing.
Yep.
So
yep.
I think, it's pretty easy to just swap one out. So I think it's about considering, like, even if this, the consequence of that pump failing is the fish die, right?
Yep.
But if you can easily access it and you can easily swap it out, then maybe you don't necessarily need to go the highest quality pump possible if you can easily change it. But if it's now somewhere where you can't get to it or you're away from your house for a long time, something like that, then we have to sort of say, all right, the consequences of failure and the likelihood and the remediation of that failure all come into play. I'd like to think of it a lot sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can think of any specific examples other than that, but yes.
I'm sorry, you cut out, so I thought you were done. I didn't mean to talk over you.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, what I was saying is, like, that's actually a place where I need to increase my redundancy. I think putting in really expensive pumps, they can still fail. And if, like, my pump shuts off right now, I've got about a day before things start dying. If it shuts off in mid-August, I've got about 10 hours. So it's a pretty big window there. Where this hurts is when we, like, want to take a vacation. And so the type of person I need here is a farm sitter, has to be at least the level of, among other things, can understand how to, like, unpackage a pump disconnect it, put a new one in, plug it back in, and make sure everything's working, and, which seems pretty easy, except when you're dealing with someone who's never done it before. Where I think I need more redundancy is that place so that I can rely on less expensive people, so I have a broader pool to draft from when I want to travel. And so, like, one of my redundancies I've thought about for that is to put in, like, a big shop air compressor, plumb in some PVC lines, and run, like, air to all those smaller aquatic systems on, like, a system that uses, like, a solenoid. So, like, you'll have a second tank, and that main tank, you always have to dump those about once a day anyway to keep them from being too wet. They accumulate water. So there's automated tools that do that. So you can have that fill up, like basically dump, you can set it to dump as long as you want. So you dump air into a secondary tank, bleed that off at about, you know, 5 PSI and push that into those ponds. And that you can set that to go off 4 or 5 times a day. And that will run for 2 days, even if that compressor doesn't kick back on, if that makes sense. And that way I've got more buffer in there. Maybe like if I'm in Mexico, I could call my buddy Dave and say, bro, my house sitter is screwed. He can't figure this out. Could you go over there and swap a pump for me or something like that? Yeah. So like, I think that like that's another thing. Like one of the things with redundancy in automated systems is if you put that automated system in so you could leave and it fails when you're gone, you got a real problem because there's no one to look at it and see that it failed. So we need to back up automation as much as we back up things that we do put our hands, I think.
Absolutely. And that's a very common thing throughout heavy industry is, you know, having those redundant systems. Like, for instance, like in control system logic, you will often have voting systems where you'll have 3 sensors and 2 of them have to vote for you to actually avoid getting a false positive or a false negative. Mm-hmm. And you'll typically have multiple systems right next to each other. So I typically work a lot on turbines and compressors, and we will have, you know, minimum of 2 next to each other, even though one can more than handle it, but you will always want that other one as a backup, and then you can stagger their operation. So you might go machine 1 and then the next time machine 2, so you get even wear, and then you have redundancy throughout it. And it's not always the same level of criticality on our homesteads, but in something like a pump, it is good to be able to have 2 systems where you can feed in, you could have a pressure sensor where it would turn on or something like that. But going to talk about the having the farm sitters on site, I think a good thing is to have that pump, as you say, but also try and develop a bit of a maybe instruction manual or a sort of a bit of a walkthrough on how you can do stuff and whatnot. I think sort of not super related, but I think another part is not just having the pump, having all your fittings, having your tooling, having your thread tape and whatnot. I think there is a huge value, especially as homesteaders and sort of people and preppers and whatnot, to have full workshop spares whenever you can. It's one of the most frustrating things when I have a small job that I have to do and I have to drive an hour into town to go and get a basic part that cost me $1.50. You know what I mean? So I really like to have as many of my tools, and I'm quite fortunate to have a proper workshop set up with full machining and welding and, you know, everything capability. But just being able to identify what are your critical spares, what are your critical tools, and having them on hand sort of thing, you know, that's a big part of making sure that you have a reliable system and that you have built-in redundancy, really.
Yeah, I think people think I'm probably like hyper-organized, and I'm not. And that bites me on that type of thing, because when I'm like, oh, I need a 45-degree, 1-inch PVC fitting, I know exactly where to go find it. It doesn't mean that where it is makes any sense to anybody but me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's next to the half inch 45 degree PVC fittings, right? It's over there because when I needed some, I went to the store and I bought it and they were in the bag and I got home and I didn't put it away and I threw the bag back in the corner. So one of the like redundancies can also be built in the way you're talking about with like kind of like social engineering. Like I need to put the whole kit together for that person. And that's actually an engineering solution, even though we don't think of it as that. Like, I'm now building the repair mechanism to the level of the person who has to do it versus me. Because, of course, I can fix it. It didn't even exist before I designed it in my head. So, of course, I know how to fix it. That does not mean – and I think what happens – and this happens to me all the time. It's so evident to me what needs to be done that I don't realize how much explanation it actually requires to the person that wasn't here when I built it. Because it's simple. It's pipes. It's a valve. Like, turn it. Like, come on. But it's not that simple when you've never done it.
Yes, yes, for sure. Just going back to that thing about organization of your workshop, I don't know if you know Adam Savage from Mythbusters. He has a YouTube channel now and whatnot. He does a lot of workshop stuff, and he has, like me, has thousands of tools, and his workshop is very crowded and whatnot. And he said his solution for putting tools or anything wherever it needs to go is the first place he thinks to put it, that's where he puts it, because he's thinking in maybe 6 months, I'm going to use this tool again and I'm going to wonder where it is. And probably the first place I thought to put it then is going to be the place I'll find it next time, sort of thing. So it really can be sort of good to do that. As you say, that social engineering is to sort of go, all right, well, how am I going to organize? What makes sense? Because, you know, you don't go to your highest level of training. You go to your lowest level of training when you actually need something, go back to the base sort of thing. I find that very helpful. Also, what I like to do is I have a fair few tractors and generators and a whole bunch of machinery. I have my workshop organized in all these tubs, and I will have, for my truck, I'll have a tub. And in that tub, I have the common service parts. I have any spares that I've accumulated. I have the workshop manual. I have everything ready to go, and a bit of a logbook where I can write down what I've done. And then every piece of equipment has its own tub. And I can just, instead of trying to look through things or try and find stuff, I just go to the bin that has tractor. And then there's my filters, there's my manual, there's my logbook. And I find that really helps out a lot to keep yourself organized and keep on track and keep a suitable amount of spares, because as soon as you've used it, you can see the bin is now empty. There's no filters in there. Order them for next time.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I did, and it's more social engineering for myself because I'm ADD and leave shit everywhere, is I have three buckets, one in my back shop, one in my front shop, and one in the underneath the pottery bench outside by my main garden area. And those are for the end of the day, and I'm supposed to put everything away, and I'm not going to put everything away. I just, whatever's out that's loose, it's not put away, I throw it in that bucket. So if it's not where it's supposed to be, it's in one of those three buckets. And I mean, they're just Harbor Freight, orange or red, whatever color they are, buckets, just sitting in a specific area where that bucket, and that bucket's not allowed to leave. Like, if anybody moves it on me again, I'm going to have to glue it to the fucking floor because I want it to be in that spot, because that's one little bit of discipline I can actually put in for myself, like, as a redundancy.
Yes, yes. There's also a real value in your workshop of having a junk space, as in, all right, I need to rebuild this pump. Where does it go? Sort of thing. And I think the problem is that you're always going to have another job, right? You're always going to have something that means that, oh, I'll just do that a little bit later. I'll just do that a little bit later.
Yeah.
And it's not, I'm not the best at it. I'm trying to get better. It's, you know, always a state of constant improvement. But I think by having an area where you can have relegated for junk, you can keep your workspaces and your actual organized spaces actually organized, sort of thing. I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. One of the things I've always said that the Army gave me as a mechanic was troubleshooting. Like, that is, when you have something fail, again, if you built it, a lot of times you're like, I know what that is. But there's times you don't, or you didn't build the whole system and a piece that you bought isn't working. And being able to go through a logical process to figure out what is the problem is incredibly valuable. What's kind of your process for troubleshooting?
I think the biggest thing is to try and actually identify what is happening. It's easy enough to sort of say, okay, the machine is broken or something is not working. And like, sometimes you can see the symptom and think that that is the actual, maybe it's a second order symptom. You might sort of think, because this is happening, this is the result. But you could have one failure leading to another one, and it's about getting to that root cause. So I think the first thing that I like to do is to do the easiest thing first, right? Because you always try and do the basic thing, like, okay, machine's rattling, let's check, are all the bolts tight, sort of thing. All right, all the bolts tight, let's go to this sort of thing. There's no point going in depth into something and going like way down into the engine if it turns out it's just your wheel nuts are loose, sort of thing. So I like to try and do that first. And then progressively, I will eliminate each step trying to get towards the root cause. But I think a big thing is that you need to avoid, basically, you can't trust what anyone else says. You have to check everything. You can't just say, the guy down the road, he told me that he checked the wheel bearings and they're fine. It's like, you can't trust anyone else because they couldn't get it working. So you can't trust them in general, right?
Yeah.
Check everything for yourself and go through systematically. You can't just jump in. You just start and work through logically.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, doctors who, when a patient goes to them for a diagnosis and they've been frustrated by others, they say, well, I'm going to run these tests. And they're like, yeah, well, they already ran those tests. They're like, yeah, that's where I'm going to start, right? I'm going to rerun them. Clearly they're missing something. We don't know what they're missing. So I'm going to start, the process through. And I always troubleshoot that way too. And it's not even that I don't trust the last person to look at it. I need to run my process to find my diagnosis, right? So when I look at troubleshooting, I try to look, okay, what does the system do? What's the end-to-end process? Now let's backtrack until we find, like, we know that this thing is supposed to send, like, the initial signal goes from A to B. Is there a signal at B? Right? It's just so the person says it's there. I don't know if it's there or not. I don't know if it's still there. I don't know if it's intermittent. I don't know what you missed. I need to know that that happened. Okay, so now I know that happened. Now what goes, like, what's that supposed to cause to happen? Now we'll check that. So just by going kind of like a linear progression, eventually when you find a place where something's supposed to happen, it doesn't, and it does happen right before that, I've now isolated that. It's not always super easy. Like, when I was in telecom, we would take something. We have a problem with a fiber optic line. You throw an OTDR on it. It's supposed to be 3,000 meters. It goes out 1,000 meters and reflects back. There's a break, and we know where it is. Like that, sometimes you can run a piece of diagnostic equipment that gives you that pinpoint accuracy. But most of the time, if you're looking at it and it's not yours and somebody asked you to look at it, and that's that simple of a diagnosis, they already did that. And they're looking for something they can't figure out. And a lot of times it ends up being little tiny itty bitty shit. I've seen things like there was this one particular type of vibe roller we used to use in the military for compressing road base. And there was a little like tube thing in it that like air vented through that actuated a switch because everything's freaking air powered on military vehicles. And that thing would get clogged up. And if you didn't know that that thing was there, you would never figure it out because everything else worked the way it was supposed to. But if you traced it, you'd know at least it's between these two spots. The solution was usually to pull it out, blow it out, and stick it back in. And it could be that simple. But I saw people fuck with those things for 6 hours and not be able to fix it because they don't have that linear mindset of like sometimes linear is bad, but sometimes linear is how you track things down.
Oh, and it sort of goes to what I was saying about trying to do progressive order difficulty. So, all right, if we suspect there's a problem with our compressed air, all right, let's check. Do we have sufficient pressure from the compressor? Yes, we do. Okay. Do we have a blockage? Okay, let's work through. I always try and do the easiest thing before you start wasting a lot of time going down into something else sort of thing. But the other thing about troubleshooting, it's more a case of repair as well. I think sometimes people get a little bit intimidated by sort of trying to do the repairs or try and fix something because maybe they're not a professional or whatever. And I think they don't have particular knowledge. And I think in some cases that's valid, right? You don't want to sort of wreck something because you don't know what you're doing. But I don't know if you're familiar with a guy called AVE. He does a lot of sort of repair videos on YouTube and stuff like that. And he has an expression. Am I allowed to? I think you swear. I'm allowed to swear, oh, yeah. Right?
Color and joy of the English language is acceptable here.
His thing is, if it's already fucked, you can't fuck it anymore. Sort of thing, right? So you might as well give it a go, sort of thing. Try it, you don't want to start drilling into the engine block of your car and not know anything about it. But if you've got a grinder that stopped working, just open it up, take a look. Has something come loose? You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to throw it out anyway,
it's already broken. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's already broken. Just give it a go.
Yeah. My dad used to tell me that, my granddad too, when I was a kid, and I want to take shit apart. Like, here, you can take this apart. It's broke. It doesn't matter what you do to it, right? Don't go taking shit apart that works. If it ain't broke,
it's not been. Yeah, exactly. It's all right. Yeah, you can't break anymore.
Yeah. No, that's valid. What about when you're building something or buying something? You might want to make sure that it's like truly fit for the purpose, and will it still be easy to maintain, repair, upgrade in the future? Like one of the things that I always look for now is like how many, like if there's a critical part, how many other systems use that critical part? Because I had a well system that had the piece that actually made the connection so that the pump would run. I don't remember what it's called now, but it was a very old system. And that piece that went on the panel, basically like closed the circuit, got fried by lightning. And when the guy came out and fixed it, he's like, yeah, I got one in the truck and you're lucky. I think we have a few. And I bought them all because he's like, yeah, they don't make this anymore. And this is the only company that ever used this particular fitting. And I try to avoid shit like that when I'm buying something new.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I think as well. I mean, there are times when, I always try and plan for how can I get spare parts in the future? How can I work on things in the future? I mean, there are times where there's only one option and you have to go with it, right? I mean, like, sometimes you get that. Or sometimes you have parts that were commonly available and then they're discontinued and you just have to deal with that. But if at all possible, like, I know that you guys love your Imperial stuff, but over here we use pretty much all metric, and it very much frustrates me when I have, like, I do keep some Imperial bolts and tools and whatnot, but the vast majority is metric. And then if I have a machine that I'm buying and it's sort of in metric or it's an Imperial, I'm always going to prioritize that because I work on it, right? Or I'll always try and get something with, you know, non-proprietary fittings. Like, I, you know, you guys often use NPT and whatnot. Over here, we use a thing called BSP fittings. I always try and keep as much as I can in that so that I can work on it, because as much as it's good to have, you know, lots of parts and spares and everything like that, it's so much better if you could use one spare part that can serve as four machines, right? Because the same fittings use the same parts, all that sort of stuff. So I often try and do that, but I also try and work out, okay, having parts is good, but how difficult is it going to be to do that? You know, depending on where I'm building or how I'm building something, what order am I putting things in so I can get to the things that I need to get to later, sort of thing? You know, it's sort of about that, like I said before, about thinking about in the future, how are we going to actually make this work? How are we going? What problems are we going to encounter, and how are we going to sort of deal with them? Really?
Yeah, I think another thing I tend to do is, like, can I eliminate something by a choice? Right? If I make this choice, does that mean there's one less thing the system needs? So there's one less thing to break. A really stupid, simple example of this is bulkheads in, like, aquatic and aquaponic systems. Yeah. And when I built my very first systems, I had somebody help me, and so I used whatever he brought, and all the bulkheads were threaded so that once you had the bulkhead in place, I don't mean the bulkhead itself was threaded. I mean the pipes that would fit into it fit in with a threaded fitting. Well, that's great, except now you need a threaded fitting on both sides of the bulkhead. So that's another thing that you need. And as soon as I found out, well, I can buy those bulkheads as a slip fitting where the pipe just goes into it and fits into it, I think, and they cost the same. And now I've eliminated two parts for every penetration, and I'll never need them. Then I went to that. And yet at the same time, there are some particular applications where it's a more reliable connection to have a thread, and you use it there. But if I don't need that, I don't want that, because now I've removed one thing from the mix. And if something breaks, that means I need also one less thing to fix it.
Agreed. But I suppose it somewhat counters that. Sometimes I like to think of what I may need in the future that I don't need now and put it in whilst I'm doing something initially, right? If you are building something, it is so much easier to add a feature when you're building it rather than to retrofit. So, like, for instance, in the case of those bulkheads, you may never need to isolate them, but if something ever happened and you suddenly needed to isolate them so you could work on them, how handy is it to have a valve in the mix, right? Even though you're never going to use it in
valve,
your day.
Yeah.
So I like to think of something like that. All right. I'm never going to, you know, actuate this, but as an emergency, it's a $5 part. I'm going to put this in. Or I don't know, in the future, am I going to need more places where I can reinforce this wall? I'm going to put another brace in. I'm going to put hooks that I don't necessarily need now because it's an easy thing now and it's just a pain in the ass later sort of thing. So that was going back to what I said before about in the start, about thinking in the future, what are you going to need sort of thing, and implementing that when you can sort of thing, even if you don't need it now.
No, I agree with that. Like, anytime I add to my water plant distribution, I'm going to tie in here and I'm going to put a new water leg in. There's a freaking cutoff valve. Like you said, they're $5. And that way I can always isolate certain areas. Maybe there's a leak. Well, I don't want to shut everything off. I want to shut off as little as possible. And I also need to shut it off, not just so the water stops coming out, so I can fix it. I don't know if you've ever tried to fix a pipe while water is blowing out of it. It can be done. It really sucks, and sometimes you have to. But if you don't want to try to, you don't want to have to. Let me put it that way. Like, you know, that's never fun.
As a bit of a trick, if you are doing that on a closed water tank, if you can enclose it up as much as you can and put a vacuum in, like a shop vac, you can actually typically tend to hold the pressure in there sort of thing in the vacuum, and you can work a bit faster. But on a pond, obviously, it's different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've had to do it like when I used to do telecom work, we do like underground construction or something. One of the guys on the crew, one of my valued employees would hit, let's say, an irrigation line, and I have no idea where to shut it off because it's in the middle of like a street easement, and everybody's mad and water's flying out of there. And I've had a few of those. That's what I'm talking about when I've had to do it with water flow. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. But even things like, let's say you're running some cable through a conduit in your roof, right?
Yeah.
Throw another cable in there, right? You never know. You're probably never going to need it, but it's just handy to have.
Yeah. We've always had, like, in telecom, that's a rule too. Like, you're pulling cable into a conduit, pull extra. But the other thing is drag a freaking pull string, a secondary string, and then leave it tied on both ends. And if you need to add a cable, you've got a string in there. Like, it's so easy to do right then. Why wouldn't you do that, you know?
Exactly. It's one of those things. It's easy to do when you're setting up, really hard to do later on.
Or when we used to do underground stuff, we did telecom, but we also, because we did that, we would sometimes pick up, like, gas line work and stuff like that. Like, and you talk to the customer and go, I noticed on the spec, we're putting this yellow poly in, 4-inch yellow poly in, doesn't conduct electricity. Well, yeah, dumbass, it's gas. Hold on. Should we put in a locate wire for you while we're doing this? Because 5 years from now, somebody else is going to put something in the same easement. And what are you going to do? Like 3 foot off the curb? Do you think it's really going to stay that way? The whole, like, and the depth is always going to be no, that's, especially with boring, like, that's not going to happen. And most of them wouldn't pay for the guide wire. It's like, we don't even need any more labor on it. We just need you to provide the material. We'll pull it in. It's really not a big, they don't want to do it.
Yeah. I heard always make it easy for the next guy, especially if the next guy's probably going to be you.
Yeah. Definitely. How do you break a bigger, complicated job down into like simple steps? Because I think that helps you tackle it without getting overwhelmed. There's so many people, they tell me like something they want to build, and like, that you could tell they're never going to do it because they're completely blown away by all the things. Where if they said, okay, phase one is this, phase two is that, phase three is this, it might seem a little easier to approach.
Yeah, I completely agree, right? Because you have to sort of break it down. Let's say you're building a chicken yard, right? The first thing, you're not building a chicken yard, first off. First thing you're doing is digging the holes for the posts. Right. So you can sort of, if you can break it up into steps, I come across people, like you say, that get overwhelmed. And you have to sort of go, okay, what is my simple goal? And then how can I do it? Okay, so today I dug the posts. Job done. Happy days sort of thing. I dare say you would have done project management and you have like Gantt charts and everything like that, you know, running a project where you will have, here is a task. Here is how long it takes. Here's when it's completed. That one then follows on to the next task. It's sort of silly, and I wouldn't actually create a Gantt chart for a yard like that. But if I can go, what needs to be done, then I can not get overwhelmed and I go, all right, I got the post in today. The next day, all right, I got the frame in today. All right, now I got the wire up. Each is its own little job, and each big job is typically constructed of smaller jobs. So by doing that, I feel like you can really get a hold on things and you can sort of avoid overwhelm and whatnot.
You kind of made a brain cell fire there when you said Gantt chart, and I just realized something I've been doing most of my life. I didn't know I was doing it, and it probably would be a good thing for people that have never done a Gantt chart to even know. And what you're talking about is, no, I am not going to actually write out a Gantt chart for an expansion of my irrigation system. But son of a bitch, what I'm not actually doing is running that concept in my head. And I don't think I've ever even realized that's what I'm doing until you just said that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, obviously I'm being somewhat hyperbolic because we're talking about this in engineering.
I think that way, and I think so the problem becomes a person that's never run jobs, never been a project manager, that type of thing. Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of, when I get certain questions, you're like, why aren't you even, like, because they've never done that. So they don't have any analog for that analogy.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? You don't know what you don't know, but you also assume that people know things that you know, sort of thing. So I often find it, as I'm typically the only person on site, and I'll go and deal with a customer. And it's a cultural thing often. People, particularly throughout Asia and whatnot, they will say yes and be very agreeable. And I'll have to try and ask them sometimes, do you understand this? And it's fine if you don't, just tell me and I'll explain it. But I'll often have people say, yes, 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 understand. And then I'll go on and sort of start talking about something. And it's clear that they didn't actually understand the first premise that we're talking about. So now they're not following. So I think it's a big case of saying, okay, do you understand this? If so, great. If not, I'll explain it. And I keep going down so that I make sure the person's got the base level understanding first, which I think is very important. Otherwise, yeah, like you said, why don't you know this? I thought you knew it.
Yeah, but why would they?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Why would a person who's never project managed anything in their life, never went to school for any kind of training that would involve that, why would they even know? Like, there's probably somebody out there, Gantt chart, like, have no fucking idea. So why would they even think that way? And it is kind of like almost reverse Dunning-Kruger, like you're saying, like, you assume somebody knows a thing they don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, well, why wouldn't you? Well, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
We got a dozen reasons that they wouldn't. Actually, there's a very narrow list of reasons that they would. They have PM jobs before. They'll know exactly what they're supposed to do. Haven't? Unless you, like I said, something in your education required it. Okay, fine. Most people don't know it. I guarantee if I went to my son, who even does things like runs P&L and stuff for his employer, and said, show me what a Gantt chart looks like, he doesn't fucking know. Why would he?
Yeah, for sure. So I suppose just as a thing for people that don't know, it basically is a list of steps that are taken a job, and it's about sort of seeing the job as its constituent parts. And then by seeing its constituent parts, then you can sort of it helps you plan and helps you execute a lot better, sort of thing. I must do this before this. And so therefore, if I must do this before that, and like say putting up the frame of a trusses for a roof, and then you put the roofing down, right? It's going to be really hard to go and start doing some repairs to the trusses once you put the roofing iron down. So identify what steps come after what and what will prohibit actions in the future, sort of thing. You know, get one step done and then move on to the next.
Yeah, I was trying to pull one up so people could see it. Finding one that's actually a good example, though, isn't as easy as you would think. I've never tried to find one before. But let me go ahead and put this up. At least it'll kind of sort of, it's so big that it fills the whole window. I wonder if I can minimize it some.
Yeah. But you'll see often when the Gantt charts are created, then they'll have one step is sort of required to complete the next one. So for instance, we see the yellow lines there or whatever. We might have some things that occur independently of each other, which would be, whilst one person is doing one job, another is doing a different job, but then some things are required. So as the time varies on one item, it will delay the start of the next item because it's a follow-on sort of thing. And you know, often a lot of the jobs that we have are like that. You know, you can't start one thing until you finish the next.
Absolutely.
You can do concurrently.
I mean, with project management, it's about figuring out like man hours do I have on this job? Who are my crews? And when am I going to spend those hours to get these steps done, like you said, because they have to go to a certain order. But I never really caught on to the fact that a big part of how I'm planning a project is I'm doing a much more simplified version of what I used to do in my head. And maybe we should be teaching that. I don't know.
The other big thing is time management and understanding that it's always going to take longer than you think it will.
Yeah.
I think you're a fan of Star Trek, right? There's Scotty time, which is the idea of, you sort of how long is it going to take? You think of how long it's going to take and you double it. So that way you can deal with it when it has to, you know, because there's always going to be something that goes wrong. So don't factor in that everything's going to go right because it never does.
Yeah. There's the crossover episode with Scotty on it with Geordi, the engineer on Next Generation. And they find Scotty trapped in this thing, you know, and he says, well, the captain wants this done. He said, well, how long is it going to take you? He says, 2 hours. He goes, so how long you tell him? He goes, 2 hours. He goes, oh, you never tell. You never tell them the real answer. You always double or triple it because these like captains are like children. They want everything now. So you have to, if you want to look like a wonder worker, you got to do that. But your point is actually more to the point. You don't know what's going to fuck up, but you do know there will be a fuck up.
Yeah.
So when you look at something and say, that's a 2 hour job. It's a 2 hour job. If I have every part that I need, if I get to start when I plan to start, if nothing goes wrong in the middle, nobody bothers me. I don't get pulled off onto something else. So how often does that happen, even with a little project in your backyard? And the answer is one word, never. That never happens.
I think you also have to sort of like, if you break a task into its constituent parts, like we're talking about the Gantt chart, and then factor in a sort of safety margin on each one sort of thing, right? You don't want to say I could get delayed an hour on this overall job. You sort of say this could be, there could be a problem with this and this and this. And it's sort of like when I go to the airport, right? If I live half an hour away from the airport, then I can deal with a half hour buffer. But if I live 4 hours away from the airport, a half hour buffer isn't enough because there can be so many times that you can have problems, right? So, sorry. Each time you sort of have to think, what could go wrong at every step? How long could every delay take and factor that in?
And when you're bidding a job, you have to then put like a sense of like, but I can only charge so much to do this. But you still want to put that kind of factor. Like we would routinely say, we'll take the labor that we think this component needs and we'll multiply it by 1.2. And we'll throw a 20% buffer onto this section. And like you said, and all the way through. And people don't do that for themselves because they think, well, there's no real consequence, right? Like, so if I'm bidding a job and I get the labor hours wrong, I can go from making a lot of money to losing my ass. Or if I'm a salesperson or estimator for the company, getting my ass fired, right? But you think, well, it's my backyard. If I go over 3 hours, it doesn't really matter. Well, it doesn't, but it does. Because you
it certainly can.
Yeah, you're frustrated. You don't get it done by the time you needed it done. There's something else you need to do, and then you know you get the honey-do list on top of it, and everything else. So you also might decide to do something and start it at a time that would be a bad time to start it. They're like, maybe this would be better. Is there anything gonna die if I don't do this? No. Do I really need this now? No. So maybe I defer that to, let's say, the next cycle, and I do something else because that time is already pinched. And by knowing that it's never like, oh, it'll fit, but it won't if I get interrupted once. Well, you're probably going to get interrupted three times.
Yes, yes. But I mean, yes, but I should also couch this by saying that, yes, plan, have everything sorted, right? But also don't let that stop you from starting. You know what I mean? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Like, I may not be able to get it finished today. Okay, then you're never going to get it finished. Sometimes you just have to start and you have to make that sort of call.
You cut out there right at the end. I think you got a sentence we didn't hear.
Oh, sorry. I apologize. It's I live in the tropics and there's a pretty big thunderstorm at the moment and I'm on Starlink, so Starlink doesn't work the best in the rain. I think I was just sort of saying that you don't want to sort of let things stop you from starting because you may not have the time to finish it or whatever, right? Like, plan, but don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Gotcha. So one of the things that you hear engineers talk about, project managers talk about, entrepreneurs running companies talk about is SOP or a standard operating procedure. Military, everything runs under an SOP. We don't really tend to have documented, especially SOPs on homesteads. Where can a simple written SOP save a family or a small farm a lot of stress, mistakes, or downtime?
Well, I mean, as you said, right? When you have your farm sitters, how useful is it if you have been able to have a written document sort of thing where you can sort of say, here is this? Or, you know, in your episodes about the documentation package about, you know, you'll always sort of go down to, in the time of, you know, problems or whatever, you go down to your lowest level of training, not your highest. So having something like a bit of a written document, here is how you swap out that pump, or here is how you start the generator. It can just make things so much easier for, you know, other people and yourself sometimes, because it, you know, helps, you know, in my documentation, for instance, I will write down what I have done to my vehicles when I've serviced them so I can remember, right? That's not so much a procedure, but it is a historical log so I can go back and, you know, sort of think about that, right? And like, see, all right, I remember this because I've written it down. And especially with the use of AI now, it becomes so much easier. You can sort of just run through something with a video or with photos with something like ChatGPT and say, help me develop this. And you can get things done so much faster by using it. And it's just very handy that I can have something that, you know, person that doesn't know or my partner or something, here it is. It's written down. Just follow this. And I think that's very undervalued. And it's, as you say in the documentation package, it's the easiest thing ever. It's cheap, it's quick, and it can save you a lot of heartache.
It also, like, I built that heavily into our AI course we did for business and marketing. And the way I explain it to the students in that course is someday you might want to sell this business. And if you have SOPs for every important thing that's done in the business, when you sell the business, you're actually selling a business. You're not just selling a customer base, because the person that purchases the business has everything they need to continue to actually operate the business. Some of the things that we build into homesteads today are fairly complicated, and eventually you might want to sell your home. So the stead part goes with the home part. And I have experienced things with buyers who are like, I really like that, but I'm afraid I won't be able to take care of it. I won't be able to maintain it. I won't be able to, you know, understand it. Like they get intimidated by something. And when you have a book that says this is how that's taken care of, that alleviates that, because whatever we do, we should always have an extra strategy for it, right? That's, you know, you have to have it, like any property you might sell someday. So you might have to, like, I'll never sell. And then you get, you know, liver cancer. Well, maybe you do need to sell it now because you only have so much time left and you want to use it for something else, or what have you. Or, you know, you just, you get an opportunity and you really want to move. And now you want to pull money out of that so you can move. Who knows why? And having those SOPs in place helps you, helps your family, but it also helps you with that exit strategy, I think.
But I think also, when you write something down, you make it real, right? So in programming, there's this concept of the rubber ducks. And what you'll do is you'll have a small rubber duck on your desk. And when you encounter a problem, you have to explain the problem to the rubber duck. It's an exercise in you explaining it. And there's this sort of saying that I think you only retain X amount of what you read, more of what you see, blah, 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 and the most of what you teach. So when you actually create a procedure, you can, and you have something written down, it allows it to actually be reviewed, right? Because when you just have something in your head, you sort of go, oh, okay. But when you actually write it down and it's concrete, then you can say, why am I doing it that way? That's retarded. I've got this step in here that makes no sense. Or it allows it to be audited by somebody else. And they say, why am I doing this? This makes no sense. And you can actually, by having something concrete, you can improve upon it rather than having it just rattle around.
Gotcha. Another thing is maintenance, right? People look at preventative maintenance as that's a really great idea, but they tend not to do it. And in the Army, we called it PMCS, preventive maintenance checks and services. And, you know, we had to, like, basically somebody who signed for a vehicle, I was a mechanic, we'd have to drag them in once every 2 weeks to make them do the preventive maintenance on their own vehicles. Sometimes simple things, you know, just like, do you actually have washer fluid for your windshield wipers so you can see in the mud when you're driving through the jungle or whatever? And what ends up happening is people tend not to do it because we always have something we need to do now. And so we don't have an SOP for maintenance. And when you have a maintenance SOP, you do things like you put on your calendar that this will be the day that I need to go out and blow all the lines out or whatever it is. And I think that people would be much better served to do that. And I know people who are just like cross every T, dot every I with it. And people kind of look at them and think, well, that person's really anal or whatever, but they're the ones who, you know, their shit never breaks, right? They're not driving around with a vehicle that's got 4,000 miles over the last oil change it's supposed to have. They're not the one with their air compressor motor burning up because they didn't change the oil in it for 4 years. Bill, I know you did that, and I know that's why it blew up on you, right? Like, so, like, do you think there's ways people could kind of implement that a bit better?
Yeah, I think going to the wards, why people often don't do maintenance. I do maintenance for a living, right? The thing about maintenance is, you spend a lot of time, a lot of money, and if everything went well, nothing changed. You know what I mean? It's not exciting, right? You like spending money on fixing things, like, or getting something new, right? But people will put a lot of effort into fixing a broken air compressor when they could have put less effort into just maintaining it and it wouldn't have been a thing, right? So it's one of those things, though, that everybody wants to say that they're maintaining things properly, right? It sort of ties in what we're talking about, procedures and whatnot. It's easy to sort of forget that, yeah, oh, no, I do my car, you know, regularly, as you say, but I didn't even think about my air compressor, right? So I think a big thing that you can do is to have a maintenance register sort of thing. And it sounds over the top, but it doesn't have to be that complex. But each time you get a new piece of equipment or something like that, you can sort of have a bit of a line item in your register where you can sort of say, okay, ride on mower. Every couple of months I need to sharpen the blades. I need to give it a service based on its hours and whatnot. And by having a system in place that you create, like ideally a CMMS, like a computer, I forget what it stands for, but it's basically a maintenance register. You can get fancy programs for that, but you can, as you say, just set up your calendar. I've seen, it's quite common on farms here, where guys will have all of their equipment written out on a whiteboard in their workshop, and they'll have what it was, when it was last done, anything that's noted from it, and then they can go through, right? I think in the modern age, we have automation that can help us sort of thing. But I think by developing a system where it will remind you and you'll get notifications, you won't just forget stuff. And you'll go, oh, that's right, I do need to do the air compressor oil. It's a 5-minute job, but it just gets forgot. So by having a system set up, you don't have to rely on you remembering things. So I have
a friend that he's really good on stuff like that, and he does really simple low tech shit on top of putting it like on the calendar reminder or whatever. But like, for example, his compressor, he does the oil change of the compressor oil 3 times a year and they're on specific dates. Well, he every year when he does the last one for the year, he makes a new list like this and it says the dates they're due and it's taped to the fucking compressor.
Yeah.
So if you're over your time, every time you walk in that shop, it's like, hey, asshole, you're supposed to do this, right? So it's just there in your face. And then once you do like your second one, you cross it off. So then you feel good. You just have to resist the temptation to use 80s mentality with the VCR and the black tape. Don't cross it off and say you'll do it tomorrow. Leave it uncrossed, you know? But like, I think the blend of that, like, I don't write a lot anymore. Like, handwriting, right? I have crappy handwriting as it is, and it's actually much worse now because I do it so little because I type everything. But there is a place for the written journal, for the written notes, for the annotated thing or something like that. I mean, my writing's so shitty when I like pack a bunch of meat up. When I get it all packed up, I have my wife write what it is on it so I can actually read it. Right? That's how bad my writing is. But there is a place still to print it out, tape it or something like that, and have that hard copy in front of you. That's right there where you look so that you'll do the thing that you know you're supposed to do. Because I think what it comes down to, I don't think most people are like, I don't care. I think most people are like, they've got so much going on in their life. If it's not front and center, it'll be like, well, I'll do that tomorrow instead of today. And then tomorrow, it isn't that they're like, fuck it. It's that they're like, they forgot about it. Like, exactly. I mean, one of the things I've done, all my hose bibs that I ever are used to like throw a hose somewhere and turn it on for 5 minutes or whatever. I'll set a timer on my phone. Well, then I'm working and I go to hit, you know, repeat or something and I hit stop instead. And 2 hours later, my wife's like, the whole backfield's flooded. Fuck. And so what I did is I got simple mechanical, those little like $8 mechanical timers. And for those hoses, I put one there. So when I need to do something like that, I just turn it to 10 minutes. It shuts itself off. Like,
I have the same thing.
Yeah.
Like I have a bunch of those. I don't know if you have them in the USA. We have these little clamshell pools. They're about 4 foot wide by about 8 inches the kids play in. And I have four of them set up in my poultry yard for my geese. And I've just made essentially a manifold, which is just various hoses going in. And I just empty each one out each day and then just turn the timer on. And then you don't have to worry about it because too often I found that I was leaving it, you know, and whatnot. So I use that. But
and then they're happy. You come out and they're all playing in the mud and shit, and you're like, damn, what have I
done? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I'm not happy, and my girlfriend's not happy. I suppose, actually, the hose bib thing, it sort of makes me think of something somewhat interesting, I suppose, in that somewhat contradictory to what I said earlier about common parts. Right? I don't use common hose fittings. So we have this system over here in Australia. It's called HoseLink. It's the best thing ever. I don't know if you've ever seen like a Chicago or Minsup style air fitting. You have a universal coupler. And so each has its own female and male components. So they will sort of lock into each other. And so they will never break. They never leak or whatever. It is a far superior system. However, it's not one that I can just go down to the local hardware and get. So sometimes it is good to sort of go away from the common if the common is shit sort of thing, right? But then you have to realize that you have to have the spares on hand because no one else will sort of thing.
Yeah.
And also about the maintenance thing as well, something as well is it's good to have certain tasks that get done at the same time. So every time I do this, I always do that. Like, for instance, every time I fill the oil in my chainsaw, I sharpen the chain sort of thing, you know, to have like those triggering events. It's better to be proactive rather than reactive.
Yeah. Now, you said you don't use standard stuff, and I get what you're saying there, but I do think standardization Absolutely. Is a good play. Like, so I do have some, for instance, with water plant, I do have some, I am standardized on 1 inch and half inch. Everything's 1 inch and half inch. I do have some 3/4 inch here and there, and I keep some parts for it. And it's because it was here when I got here.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to tear, you know, 100 foot of pipe out of the ground because it's the wrong size or whatever. But I try to be standard. Like, I have the standard pipe sizes. So that means I try to have all the fittings in that size, all of the bushings in that size, all the adapters that goes from one to the other in that size. And then I use 2 inch for returns. And so I have 2 inch material for that. And it makes it so much easier than having 5 or 6 different things, because you always know what you need. Like, it's out there. That part of the property is all on 1 inch. I need 1 inch shit. I'll grab my 1 inch bucket with all my stuff in it. And it makes repairs, fixing, expansion, everything easier to standardize. On my pumps, I have 2 pumps. I have a little one and a big one. And I keep, like you said, I keep redundancy on the shelf at all times. There's 2 little ones and 2 big ones on a shelf. And when I get them in, I take them out of the box. I take all the shit off them that I don't need, all the crap I'm going to throw away anyway. I take all the styrofoam out and get rid of it. I just set it in the box and put the box on the shelf. So it's literally, you pull it out and it's less than 5 minutes to walk, get it, and replace it. And the more you can do like that, the better you'll do it. The other thing I do with the pumps, this is kind of a thing I started doing recently. I have 2 classes of pumps. This one's never been used and this one's been used. And so what I'll do is every once in a while, like the oldest pump in the system, and it's been the longest since it's been clean, cleaning those things is a bitch. I'll pull it. I'll set it out in the sun. I'll take it apart. I'll put the new one in place and I'll wait till all that shit dries and it's easy to clean it. I'll clean it and I'll put it back and put the new one back in the box. And that makes me keep everything clean. And that is way more important, because now the pumps last longer and fail less. Because sometimes they don't fail because they're broken. They fail because they clog up with fish shit and other things.
Yeah, we would call that having a rotable spare. But yeah. I suppose what I was also getting at is often if something is popular and common, it means that it's probably pretty good. But not always. Sometimes, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's good. It's kind of like saying that McDonald's is healthy because it's popular, sort of thing, right? Yeah. Sometimes it's shit, and sometimes you need to actually go, you all have crap stuff, here is the better option. But it's about analyzing it, not just assuming one or the other.
Yeah, is it better, but also can I get it?
Yes, exactly.
If I have to wait 3 months to get it because it's really good, how long is it going to take me to get shit to fix it?
And so, exactly, hence.
I'm not even saying don't do that. I'm saying if you know that, then you better figure out the common failure points and have redundant parts for those failure Absolutely. Points. Kind of like my old well system that I'll never have that again. Again, sometimes though you have to work with what you have because it was there when you got it. Like that well pump, that's when I bought the house. I would have never even thought about it. I wouldn't even know everything I know about it if it didn't get hit by lightning. Twice, by the way. Yeah. Can you talk about maybe how have you implemented some of this stuff in your own efforts? Like, what do you do as far as homesteading? And, you know, is there any thing that you're particularly proud of that you built, or, you know, that you use on a regular basis to produce something for yourself or for a customer?
So, like I said, I travel very frequently and I go sort of, you know, around the world, and I'll often be at the drop of a, you know, sort of, I just go, I might have to go to Japan today, for instance. You never know. So a big thing for me was trying to put up as much automation as I can and try to make systems easier for my partner to handle when I'm away, sort of thing. So we actually are a registered goat breeding stud. We have Nigerian dwarf goats that we breed, and we have goats, sheep, pigs, chickens, ducks, geese, everything, sort of thing. So I try to put as many systems in place to make it easy to have things. So all the feed goes to one area. All of the water is automated. The reticulation is automated. I try and factor in easy gates and lanes so that I can transfer animals from paddock to paddock, that sort of thing. I mean, it's more about just putting the system in place that I tend to think of, sort of thing. I mean, I have like a bunch of things that I built around here and whatnot. So I built most of my structures and I built a lot of my machines out here and whatnot. But it's more a case of the systems that I'm more proud of.
Gotcha. I know you have a website and a podcast. You want to tell folks about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's something I've recently – so our website is bluewaterbarnyard.au. So I don't know if there's going to be too many people from your audience that's wanting to buy goats in Australia, but we also have a bit of a social media page there that my partner runs. We sort of focus a lot on, you know, veterinary care and stuff like that. At the moment, we're about to do a bit of a post. One of our breeding goats, she actually broke her leg the other day. So sort of showing the realities of dealing with that one there on the right. She broke her leg the other day. So the realities of actually dealing with you know, breeding goats and stuff like that. Actually, somewhat related. I remember a couple of chats back with the Tuesday morning coffee chats. I think you were talking about 3D printing and how you sort of didn't know that it was really for you, sort of thing. Yeah. I get that. It's interesting. Like, I actually managed to use my 3D printer. I printed her a shoe or a cast so that she can walk around better, sort of thing. Because it's one of those things, utilizing the tool. Like, you have to do 3D modeling and everything like that. But it is sort of cool to see how certain things that you don't think would be useful to you, if you actually try and apply an innovative sort of spin to them, you can use them as tools around your homestead and whatnot. I've also recently started a podcast called the Tropical Homesteading Podcast, and it's sort of more for hot weather and tropics in its general thing, but it's also things about like foraging or utilizing metalworking or maintenance and whatnot. So it is sort of more of a larger thing, but it's also specified more on people in the hot tropics, because I feel like there's not that much of that stuff around.
Very cool, man. Well, hey, I appreciate you being with us today and hanging out for a little over an hour. I think it was a good discussion, and I think maybe it'll help people think about implementing more redundancy. I think that's one of the big things we hit on today, is that I think people design systems, even when they're well designed, they're not designed with an acknowledgement that it probably will fail at some point. And there's ways that, you know, you can have immediate redundancy. You can have implementable redundancy, like having my pumps on the shelf. That's good. But if there was a second pump that automatically turned on, and that might be better, actually, because no one would have to do anything. It would just turn itself on. So, you know, thinking like that. And then I think the other thing is, and I really encourage people to do this, don't get paralysis by analysis paralysis, right? Don't not do something because you think forever and never take any action. That's bad too. But there's also people that they just move too fast. They don't really think through the implication. That's kind of, we started off today, like, by putting this thing here and now it's isolated, well, how's it gonna work with all the other things that I want to do? And do I really want to do this? And down to things like, you know, animals are great, but, like, you know, you said you have a partner, so when you leave, there's somebody there to take care of them. One thing about animals, they tie into the land. Like, it makes it much harder to leave. It's very easy to get somebody to take care of a dog. Betsy, there's all kinds of dog sitters. I really come let your dog out 3 times a day and pet them and play with them. Or you just leave them out in the yard if you have the right place and have somebody come feed them and check on them and whatever. You know, when you have ducks and you have chickens and you have fish tanks that require pumps, and like, all of that makes it harder. And we're actually either adding redundancy or eliminating certain things right now because we're entering a phase of our life at our age where we want to travel more. And so think about, like, adding this thing. Well, I want pigs and chickens and goats. Do you like to go on vacation? Right? Do you know, and redundancy might be putting in a tiny house and have a tenant that actually can help you. Like, there's more than, like, redundancy is not always another part or a backup system. Sometimes it's another human element, but you got to have it or you're going to really wish you did. And now you're stuck. Right now, what do? Do you kill all the animals because you realize that, or do you try to sell them? Like, it's not as easy to deal with sometimes as people think.
Yes, I think I saw some people talking about Murphy's Law earlier, sort of thing. I'm not sure if you're sort of familiar with Murphy's Law, how it actually came about, because it's not actually quite as negative as people say. People say that Murphy's Law is, if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. Yeah. The actual thing Murphy said was, if something can't go wrong, it won't go wrong, sort of thing. And it actually came about, I believe, from he was an engineer, and I think they were doing testing of accelerometers for something, for like jetpacks or rockets or something to that effect. Okay. And they had all these sensors, right? And these sensors, they were sort of omnidirectional, so you could put them in backwards, and they ended up installing all of these sensors backwards, and they lost all of their test data. So he sort of said, well, that was stupid. Why do we make it so that we can put them in backwards? Let's change it so the pin can only go in one way. So that way you can't have a fuck up, because it's impossible to fuck up.
You've designed out failure.
Yeah. That's actually more of a positive thing than people think it is. You know, yeah. The movie
yeah. Yeah. I got one question for you here. And, when you start answering, I got two dogs in my face. I'm going to go put out. I'll be back in 30 seconds. What is your favorite project you have implemented in your life? And I bet you they're letting you go outside of homesteading there. So
it's a bit of a tricky one, actually. What's my favorite project? I mean,
what is one of your favorite projects?
Okay. I suppose I very much like making my own tools. I think that's one of my favorite things, to be able to, come up with a new tool that can fix a problem that I had before. I've recently got into machining to be able to do that, or to be able to use this 3D printer that I've been dealing with now. I find that I'm able to solve small problems that I didn't even realize. Like the ice tray on my freezer was broken. I was able to print a new one, sort of thing. To be able to have little things that I can just fix, that's what really sort of I like more than building, I suppose. All the other projects that I tend to make are pretty standard. I've fully customized my boats and my vehicles so that they make them off-grid vehicles, that sort of thing. But yeah, more I just like fixing things. That's my preferred project.
Okay. Well, I'll find out what that is when I listen to it after I put the show up, because my idiot dogs, like, there's a redundancy. I left the back door open for them, but they wanted to go out the front door.
Yeah, I made sure I put mine in her yard this morning before she goes. I have a large German Shepherd, and she wants to go sometimes. Yeah, not gonna. Yeah. She's pretty loud.
So anyway, man, thanks for being here. I'll make sure the links, all your stuff, are in the show notes today. Folks that are listening on the video, either watching live or later, there's a link down in the video notes there. It'll take you right over to the audio version on my site. If you're watching it live, it'll be up in about 30 minutes. If you're watching it after the fact, it's probably up already. You can find Abraham's Facebook page, his website, his Instagram, and his podcast all in the notes there. Hey, man, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
All right, real quick, let me wrap up. I didn't tell you guys about the item of the day yesterday because the show went really long, so I'm just running the same one again today. And this actually fits our discussion fairly well, by happenstance, I guess. These are the Energizer Power Failure Lights. And this is one of the easiest redundancies you can put into your home. The link that I have for you in the write-up on these goes to a three-pack for about $50. What they are is basically three flashlights that can act like nightlights. They don't have to, though. You can set them so that when it gets dark, they kind of come on and act like a nightlight in the hallway or what have you, or they don't. But what they will do is, if power goes off to your house, you have them plugged into a live outlet, as soon as the power fails, they'll turn on like you see there in the image. And that way you have all of those lights on and you can see where you're going. The other thing about them, they're in a little, kind of sit in a cradle like an old school phone, if you remember those, if you're old, right? And so you pick it up and it's basically a flashlight you can take with you. These are awesome. I have six of them in my home. And I'm telling you, I would rely on them probably more if I still had kids in the home. Imagine that you're taking a shower, you have soap in your eyes, the lights go out, and you're in the bathroom, so now it's pitch dark. One of your kids is young, so they're crying and screaming for you, and the other spouse is gone. The other kid's downstairs yelling and bitching because his video game shut off. And you're in the dark, wet, with soap on your face, trying to get to your kids. Not fun. Well, with these, at least you can see where you're going and get things done. I keep one in the bathroom, keep one in the hallway, that type of thing. And that way, as soon as that power goes out, those lights are on, and they are a first line. In other words, like, you're going to get to the point where, like, I need to go turn the generator on, or I need to do this or that or whatever. This is not going to, like, save the day in of itself. But that's that first ability to, like, go get your blackout kit out and other things like that and get everything else set up, because at least you can see. And they are pretty foolproof. And I'm going to tell you, I had a couple different products like this that I recommended in the past, and I stopped recommending them and didn't start recommending them again until a few years ago. And this is why. Inevitably, every single version of this product that I've ever recommended, eventually they stay plugged in long enough. There's a little bit of bleed charge over or whatever. The batteries go bad, and instead of not working, they turn themselves on and they won't go off, and it's aggravating as shit. And there's nothing you can do about it except with these. These use a standard rechargeable battery. They have four screws. You take the four screws out, you throw the batteries away, you put the new batteries in, you put the cover back on, you put the four screws back in, and you go on with your life. That is well engineered. That's not designed to fail. What I do with mine, we talked about preventive maintenance today, right? I have on a schedule every 2 years. I don't care if they're still working. I take all the batteries out, throw them all away, and replace them. And that way they always work. These are great. Again, they're made by Energizer. Energizer power failure lights. These belong in your home. And especially, again, I said, if you got a family, you got kids, especially young kids, this is a huge deal. It's also really, like, if you have older parents, you might want to make sure they have these. Your mom, who uses a walker, but can still get around, is walking through the hallway. Power goes off. She can't see. Wouldn't it be great if that didn't have to happen? It doesn't have to happen. Backup generators are awesome, like a Generac or something, but they're thousands of dollars. I'm not saying don't get one. I'm saying if you don't have one and aren't going to be getting one anytime soon, at least put something like this in place. Again, Energizer Power Failure Lights. You can find them at thesurvivalpodcast.com. They'll be in today's show notes, linked down in the video notes. Again, you can click and get on over there to do that. And you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And remember, you can help us out no matter what you buy. All you got to do is start your shopping there. Doesn't even take you but a couple extra seconds to do it. Doesn't cost you any more money whatsoever. Also, consider picking up a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirico. All the redundancy and things we were talking about in our life today, wouldn't it be great if you could actually design stuff like that into your life? Like your life goals, your life arc, your career trajectory, your career. That's actually what Laws of Life really is all about. You can learn more about it. Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by me, myself, and I, Jack Spirgo, available at Amazon.com. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with Expert Counsel Q&A show for the week.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.